have to admit I don't like pizza. I love it. And I am prepared to do literally anything to get my hands on a slice. Liz Truss.
Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. Court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Welcome to another episode of Court is in Session. The title of this episode is Breach of the Public Trust, that's spelled with two S's, a British political disaster. And for this episode, we have Francois Delecto, who is a serial guest on this show. Honestly, I feel even weird calling him a guest because he's on here so often, and he does contribute to the direction of the podcast quite a bit. And for the first time, we have my good friend from undergraduate, Corey Adamick. I guess I also knew him in law school. Well, good FSU friend. Known him for a long time, and I consider him a good friend. And he is something of an Anglophile and knows more than any of my other friends what the heck went on with Liz Truss. So just kind of a little bit of background, Corey. Can you give us a bit of a summary play-by-play of what happened over the past 6 weeks with Prime Minister Truss?
Yeah, of course. First, I want to thank you, Court, for having me on. I know we've been talking about it for a while, and it's fitting that this should be the thing that actually gets me on. But where would you like, do you want me to start at, I guess, Boris's downfall, just the thing that started all of this?
You have the short version of Boris's downfall, because that was like a year-long
The shortest version is that Boris had to resign because he had problems with some of his caucus in the parliament because of an ongoing Partygate scandal, I guess you could call it, that occurred.
Sorry for party rocking, right, guys?
Exactly.
That's the Boris Johnson story.
That was one of the issues. And then there was another issue that came up that sort of caused people to lose faith in him. So then that brought us to the first, I guess, leadership election for the Conservative Party, where you saw the two major people to come out of that were Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak. And evidently, we all know now that Liz Truss won the trust of the party and its members. And nice. He managed to just completely... I don't know, fail as about as epically as you possibly could in public office. I mean, essentially the big issue was she proposed a budget for the first time in forever, because I guess the British government doesn't like proposing budgets. And people didn't like that her budget was more from a supply side standing of economic theory. And so,
well, not just people, right, Corey? It was like the international bond market, or more specifically, the British government bond market, right?
That is correct. Yeah. So she was facing issues from the international economic community, and then at home. And so, you know, she encouraged her Chancellor of the Exchequer to release this budget and to propose essentially tax cuts on everyone, including tax cuts on the most wealthy, which is what I guess brought about a big ruckus on social media. And so we saw that carry over into sort of news coverage, and it sort of blew up her momentum that she had built up, whatever momentum that may be. So once that sort of took over the airwaves, the easiest way to explain it is that she just imploded. She decided that she wasn't going to take this stand on this policy that she believed in, and she was going to fold to the public pressure. And so she ends up actually sacking the chancellor that implemented the budget that she wanted because... because he was unpopular on social media, and because the budget, and because the public sort of began speaking out against them. And then,
so was it just the public though? Because like the London Stock Exchange really tanked because of that too. And that's something that I was always a little bit surprised about, is why, as a result of the initial like tax cuts and more conservative rollback policies on spending that she had implemented, that usually those things will have, you know, a lot of crap on social media. That's to be expected. But right. there was a lot of shakeup in the British economy, whereas you'd expect a boost. Do you know why that happened? Was the social media influence just that strong, or was the were they getting leaned on a little bit by the international community, and that kind of threw that into a tailspin?
Well,
or can either of y'all speak to that?
Well, I was just going to say that it was my understanding that basically the internet, both the international and the domestic market of government bond traders, like whatever the UK equivalent of treasuries is, were really, really incredulous that this mini budget is, I think that's why they call it, I'm not sure they called it the mini budget proposal, would create enough growth to allow to expand government revenue sufficiently to let them keep up with their debt payments. And okay. Since the pound sterling is not a global reserve currency as the US dollar is, they don't have the same privilege of basically unlimited borrowing that this country has, which to effectively caused interest rates to shoot through the roof and mortgage payments exploded, which put extreme pressure on everyone considering how high energy prices already were there. And it basically threw the entire economy into meltdown. That's my understanding of it. Does that sound about right, Corey?
Yeah, that sounds about right. That sounds about right. But I think ultimately this whole panic that we saw with the economy and with the crashing of the stock market, you can't say that it's unattached from the reaction on social media, because from my observations, purely speculative, it was essentially the press and, you know, these people in power who are opposed to this budget, they began stirring up this worry, this controversy that, oh, the stock market's going to crash, the economy's going to falter. And essentially that's what happened. Like you said before about the speculation, that was ultimately what caused us all to downfall. You know, it was these people in power that were saying, oh, this budget's never going to work. And they scared enough people into believing that it wouldn't work, that it sort of just led to a domino effect where it then didn't work.
I just want to throw in again that I don't think it's fair just to chalk it all up to social media and the people, because like if I recall correctly, and I might be mistaken, like the bond market crashed like within 24 hours of this budget proposal. Like it was very, very fast. So like this wasn't just people, this was investors, this was like essentially Britain's pool of creditors, that the people the government relies on, has always relied on for funding public spending, public deficits in that country. Like this isn't just tweet on Twitter, this is the people, this is like investors, this isn't just like the mob, the Twitter mob is like,
yeah, no. When I say people, I'm not referring to just the Twitter mob. I'm just saying everyone, you know, that includes some of these people that were mad on social media, that includes people in the media itself, that includes these creditors, that includes everyone involved essentially in the British economy. It all sort of flipped a switch overnight. You know, people began saying, oh, well, it's sort of what happens when you get traders on the stock market that predict a stock downfall. And so they start all selling off their stock, and then that causes the stock downfall. It's that same sort of, you know, court is more economically educated in that aspect, but that's essentially my understanding of how that sort of works. And that's essentially what happened here in Britain.
I mean, it definitely, those kinds of things can create a self-fulfilling prophecy where by believing that an economy is going to go into a downfall, that there will be an economic downturn. That's why people take things like economic confidence and how into play so much when determining whether there's an actual recession going on, or two, whether there's going to be one in the future. Now, do you think that to kind of change the conversation a little bit, do you think that her downfall was because of bad economic policy? Or do you think it was more so that she flip-flopped so immediately and so dramatically that she caved on one of her core issues so quickly that she just didn't seem like a strong, good prime minister? Like, would it have been better for her to stick to this maybe bad policy or walk it back more subtly? Would that have allowed her to stay in office for perhaps a little bit longer?
Well, I think it's absolutely the latter part of what you just said. You know, if we think about big figures in British politics, you think of the person she was trying to emulate, Margaret Thatcher. One of her core beliefs was that if you're polling popular well ahead of an election, you're doing something wrong. Her belief was that essentially you have to do what you believe is going to be better off in, you know, in the long run, despite what the public might immediately knee-jerk react to. And eventually you have to trust that if you're doing what is right and if you are predicting the positive outcomes that you're implementing, then that should have, you know, sorted itself out by the time the election comes around. And we saw almost an immediate turnaround in her sort of core belief, however core it might have been. It was essentially, she woke up one morning and decided, well, I'm going to completely actually abandon this budget that I just spent all this time putting together. You know, there's that meme going around of her saying, I'm a fighter, I'm not a quitter. And then the very next day she announces that she's resigning, and that pretty much encapsulates it perfectly. She didn't have what it took. You know, we think about, again, Margaret Thatcher, the Iron Lady. Liz Truss was no Iron Lady. She was only an Iron Lady in the sense that she was like an iron ingot when you throw it into a lake. It sunk all the way to the bottom almost immediately. And that's certainly
what... That was beautiful. Did you come up with that on the spot?
That's classified, but...
That means he stole it from the internet.
No. I definitely came up with that, but the length of time in which I did come up with that is to be left ambiguous. But essentially, her position also wasn't helped by the way the Conservatives were polling at 20% in the national polling elections. You know, and that wasn't even the lowest they were getting in their polls. And so when you're talking about a parliamentary system in which your position of power is due to the confidence of the government, she lost the confidence very quickly. And she had no authority whatsoever to command any sort of confidence.
So with her leaving, that kind of puts the Conservative Party in a pretty tight position, to say the least. You're talking about their polling numbers being at something like 20% now, whereas when she came in, they were relatively popular, if I understand that. They had a pretty big election.
They were down three against Labour right when Boris Johnson left office, if I recall correctly.
Yeah,
so they were down just a little bit.
Popular is, I suppose, relative. In regards to where they're polling now, they were certainly more popular. But they
30 points or so.
they were maybe like 5 to 10 points behind Labour in the polling, which of course could have sorted itself out by the time the election came around in 2024. But you know, now you're talking about 40-point deficits.
Yeah, that's true.
So
it certainly all fell apart very quickly.
So where does that leave the future of the Conservative Party? I mean, first of all, what is the field looking like for people who can take over? I know she had said that she that they were planning on choosing somebody by the end of the week. That seemed pretty ambitious, but probably we'll see somebody next week, I would think, to take her place. I would think. I don't know how quickly these things usually move, but who do you think it's going to be? What's the future of the party looking like? They have to have an election by 2025. Am I making that up? January 2025. So what is the political path forward for the Conservative Party? I know I asked you like several questions there, but can you speak generally to that?
In terms of who might replace her, I think it became pretty apparent today that there's only one person who might replace her. that is Rishi Sunak, who she had originally faced in the first leadership race. And we might hear that announced as soon as tomorrow or the middle of this week. And that's incredibly fast turnaround, mainly because there doesn't seem to be a solid coalition forming against Rishi enough to sort of stop him. So with the number of seats that the Conservatives have in Parliament, they have about 350 or so, give or take. And so when they're nominating this leadership position, you know, you need at least 100 votes to get on the ballot. And the three main people that were in the contest were Rishi, were Penny Mordaunt, and our boy Boris. And well, he announced today that he was not going to stand for nomination. You know, you can speculate as to what his real reasoning might have been, but the reasoning that seems to be making the rounds is that he was upset that he wasn't able to get the party essentially to coalesce. He wasn't able to get Penny Mordaunt and Rishi Sunak, who are the other two people, to sort of agree to co-govern essentially. And he basically was worried that if you couldn't get a unified party, you couldn't govern properly. And so with that being said, he announced he wasn't standing. And so Rishi, I think his last total had him at about 160 or so backers, which leaves, you know, give or take 150 to 200 people who could possibly back Penny. But at the same time, you know, we haven't really heard much commotion about that. So my guess is that Rishi might be the only one who's actually on the ballot. And if he is the only one on the ballot, then he, you know, gets the nomination. I don't know. Pierre, did you want to say anything?
I just wanted to throw in that Rishi and
Francois, not Pierre. Sorry.
Pierre is the alter ego of a different individual on Twitter.
Right.
No, I was just gonna say that Rishi and Boris actually have an interesting little bit of drama, because Rishi was a backbencher until Boris appointed, I think, to be Chancellor of the Exchequer in 2020. But in this past leader, right before this past leadership's campaign, Rishi was the first major minister to resign from the Johnson government, and that caused a whole cascade of about 50 ministers and other government officers to resign. That kind of ultimately led to Boris having to leave, which is why Boris actually quietly backed Liz Truss in that leadership election, which put her over the top. So there is a little bit of drama and tension between these two going into this election.
That is correct. There's a big divide in the Conservatives in Parliament right now between essentially the pro-Boris backers and the pro-Rishi backers. You know, each of the candidates, Boris and Rishi Sunak, have their own problems that they're dealing with. Like I said before, with Boris, it was Partygate issues. And with Rishi, there were questions about his time at the Exchequer, especially during COVID. So we'll see how he might deal with that. But that being said, if he is the only nominee and he does take over, that essentially gives him command of the party for the foreseeable future, at least until the next election, should he last that long. In terms of where his policy is, I've heard him described as somewhat more towards the right of the party. It's actually an interesting dynamic. So Rishi is more on the right side of the party and Liz Truss is more on the left side of the party, but each is essentially despised by their representative factions. You had members on the right side of the party who were backing Liz Truss because they don't like Rishi. And you had members on the left side of the party who were backing Rishi because they didn't like Liz Truss. So it's going to be very interesting to see how he comprises his cabinet. I mean, is he going to wipe out all of the Truss supporters, sort of like Truss did with Sunak when she took over? Or is he going to try to mend bridges? I couldn't really tell you, but that is only up to time. What I can tell you is you know, conservatives should be worried. I mean, they've had control of government for over a decade now. They've had control of government for 12 years, and this is where they are now. You know, it's not exactly a solid party. They got Brexit done. But other than that, they haven't really done anything. You know,
actually, if you let me interject, I do believe they re-legalized fox hunting.
Oh, okay.
About time.
So they got Brexit done and they re-legalized fox hunting.
They actually did the fox hunting first because that was a higher priority, I believe.
Okay. Well,
didn't the fox hunting thing, didn't that, there was a pretty big kerfuffle over that, if I remember correctly. Is that where they
because a bunch of lefties and liberals were like, it's animal cruelty, blah, blah, blah.
Fox hunting was illegal for that long.
Yeah. I mean, you know.
Well, you know, it's Britain. You know, pretty much everything is illegal.
Yeah, that's fair. For fox hunting now. They got that back.
Yeah. It's about time.
It's tradition, right, after all. Right. It was actually funny. When he first got into cabinet, a rather eccentric Tory party member, Jacob Rees-Mogg, I think was known for forcing the civil servants in his ministry to start using the old imperial units instead of the metric system again. Because he's just that old-fashioned. So there were little elements of conservatism in the actual conservative party the past 12 years, but they were mostly seemed to have been symbolic in nature.
Oh yeah, don't get me wrong. There's still conservatives in the conservative party, but none of them can seem to win leadership elections. I mean, in terms of the economic policy of the conservative party, I've heard it described to the left of the Labour Party. I mean, you have a conservative government who won't even return the tax policy to where it was under the last Labour government. That's the absolute state of the Conservative Party right now.
Well, it should be noted that the previous Labour government under Blair had unique ties to the financial world of the United Kingdom, so that might explain the previous tax policy a certain extent.
I mean, that
to cite an American analog, it's kind of like the Clinton administration, where
while it
was a Democratic administration and they were pretty conservative in their, you know, fiscal policy.
Yeah, there's, I think, actually a term, it even has a Wikipedia page called Blatcherism, where Tony Blair did appropriate certain corporate and tax policies from the Thatcher years and more or less continue them. Certain ones, not all of them.
And more power to him. But all I'm saying is that the conservatives, they can't even seem to get to that. And the conservatives are supposed to be conservative. You know, they're supposed to be the Thatchers, and they can't even get to the labor right essence of Thatcherism that existed under the last labor government.
Well, let me just say that the conservative and unionist party is the oldest continuous political party ever still in existence. And that it goes way back before Margaret Thatcher, and there is an economic history preceding her in that party. So I think it's a little more complex than just saying they need to get back to Thatcher. There's some pre-Thatcher elements that never completely went away. Like, this party has been in continuous existence since like 1820 or something, and it's in some forms you could argue it goes back to 1680.
Well, yeah, but you know, regardless of how old the party is, I mean, the Republican Party goes back to the 1850s. And when we think of the Republicans, we think of, you know, lower taxes, we think of supply side economics, and that's largely because of Reagan, to sort of attach an American equivalent to it. And, you know, that's what we expect from Republicans. And so I don't think it's unfair to expect the same of conservative leaning parties in other countries.
So do you think with Brexit being over and with this kind of lackluster at very best economic policy from the conservatives, from what I'm hearing, it sounds like it wouldn't be hard to think that the average British voter would say that, you know, these conservative governments have kind of gone past their usefulness, and it may be time for a change if there's really not anything that conservatives are able to do that the Labour Party can't, and maybe Labour Party would be able to run a better government. At least that's might be what a British voter would think.
I think that's absolutely fair to assume. And that's something we see sort of being resembled in public opinion polling. And I think that's why conservatives are going through all of this mess and refusing to call an election right now, because they know they would get absolutely curb stomped. And so they're trying to avoid that in every way possible. We'll see if they're actually able to hold off an election. But, you know, I like to think of myself as a fairly conservative economically conservative person. And actually conservative, you know, all around. But in my personal opinion, looking in, even I couldn't support, I think the best thing to do right now is to call an election. I think the conservatives need some time in the wilderness to sort of refine themselves and to realize, you know, how good they've had it, and to realize sort of what draws people to their party. They seem to have gotten distracted from that in favor of, oh, well, we just need to maintain power. That's our number one goal.
Well, I'd just like to insert there with a reference from a quasi-famous British journalist who goes by the name of Peter Hitchens, the brother of the more famous Christopher Hitchens. The Conservative Party essentially exists as a mechanism to acquire high office for the Sons of Gentlemen and for no other purpose. And that may not be a perfectly true statement, but I think there has been, I think there is some truth to that. If you going back at least to the Cameron years, which started this current decade or so, as you mentioned, of conservative rule, where the party really kind of does exist not to do anything except to get the children of upper middle class or lower upper class people into public office so they have something to do. That is David Cameron would be the quintessential example of that.
Well, I mean, if that's the case, you could ask yourself how useful the Conservative Party is at all.
Oh, not at all. That's the other thing he says. He says the Conservative Party is in the way of an actual Conservative Party existing mostly because the name is misleading.
Exactly. I don't disagree with you on that at all. I think, you know, I'm not British, so I shouldn't tell them how to run their governments and how to run their parties.
Well, why don't you do that anyway, just for shits?
I was about to say, this is very widespread podcast in Britain. You know, 85% of the British people listen to this podcast. So I think you can sit here and tell them what to do.
I mean, he's already endorsed Labour, so.
Only in this particular instance, because I think it's a lesson that needs to be learned. Listen, I think this is the classic paradox of the good times create weak men and weak men create bad times and bad times create strong men and strong men create good times. You know, that circle that we always get seen tossed around. I think that's exactly what's happening with the Conservative Party and what's been happening for the last few decades is they've sort of had it so good electorally that they've forgotten what it is to be in such a dire straits that they are now. And I think it's a lesson that they need to learn, just personally.
Well, we're coming up to about the half hour time on our podcast, which is generally what I like to keep around, although I'm very bad at keeping it at half an hour. But first of all, Corey, since you're a new member on this show, this is the first question I ask, but we just kind of hopped right into it. But new guests on my podcast. It's a fun one. If you could live under any government in world history, which one would you choose? I love blindsiding people with this question because it's such a – the knee-jerk reaction is a fun one.
Oh, wow. That is a tough one. Let's see. So is this question asking about any government at a specific time in history?
Any government, any time. And you could play with it. Like if you wanted to say, you know, King Charles the First, but as an American in 2016. Yeah. Like It's, you know, say whatever you want, play with it as much as you want.
Oh, wow. Okay. You know, personally, I would probably. Oof. I'd have to go with Coolidge, I think.
Ooh, that's a good one. I like Calvin Coolidge.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of people that you can choose from. I feel like Reagan is too, you know, it's too basic. I tried to be a little original. So I think Calvin Coolidge embodies the sort of laissez-faire big government, or I should say non-big government sort of attitude that I think really helps communities prosper. And so if I got to pick anyone, sort of trying to dissect it from the time period that it governed across, I would probably pick that one.
It's a good one. Anything else you want to leave our two listeners with before you're off on your first time on the show?
I mean, I would like to know what other people have chosen in the past, just so I can sort of have a frame of reference, if you have that.
Well, Francois here chose the Bill Clinton administration of the 90s.
That's a joke. That was I gave a real answer immediately after that.
He did. And I can't remember what the real answer was.
I think I might have said I either said Wilhelmine Germany or I said France under the first Napoleon. But I also might have said 1890s Britain. I was one of those three, but I don't remember which one.
Yeah. And then
but I feel like I said Wilhelmine Germany. That seems like something I would have said.
Yeah. And I know when I had Alex Hinson on here, I think he said during the Trump administration, which makes sense because he worked for the Trump administration.
I guess really the real answer is any government where you're in power.
So. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, he was the White House liaison to the Treasury, which seems like a really cool job. That's a liaison between, you know, the president and where the money is. Like
Steve Mnuchin.
Yeah, exactly. So that was a pretty solid one. And I don't know what Alex said. So I don't know.
I think he said, probably, I believe if I can recall, Alex said, the United States government between the Constitutional Convention and the Whiskey Rebellion.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's right. That's right. So like the first 2 years.
The first 2 years of the Washington administration, just the first before the first Washington midterms.
Yeah.
No, I'm honestly surprised he chose any government at all, but or power.
Yeah. Trump. Well, I mean, he'll tell you he's a minarchist, and I don't think that's ever really happened.
Minarchism has never happened.
When does minarchism happen? I mean, I'd
say mid-Victorian England was effectively minarchism. Like this, you basically did not interact with the state except unless like there was maybe a constabulary on your block or you got mail. That was it. I call that minarchism.
That's probably fair. That's probably fair. Yeah. I wonder if
like
that
would be the closest. Because isn't minarchism defined as the quote unquote night watchman state? That is pretty much life in Charles Dickens' Victorian England. That's what it was. It was a modern industrial society, but it was effectively a night watchman state domestically. Empire was a different question, ran completely differently. They behaved completely differently in the rest of the world than they did at home. But
yeah,
within England, definitely, it was effectively a night watchman state, to the best of my knowledge.
It definitely wasn't like the libertarian monarch, but because our disinterested monarch and our what it wasn't libertarian monarch, anarcho monarchy is what we called it. Like the monarch was interested in trains or something like that. But that certainly wasn't the case. Yeah, that was the Tolkien
definition. No, that's a separate. Yeah, different. Because it was parliamentary. It was basically a parliamentary constitutional night watchman state is what Victorian England was effectively in the domestic scene. Yeah, to my understanding.
But anyway, that was a fun little rabbit hole that I think Corey didn't expect us to go down. But that's...
No, I'm glad I was able to lead us down that rabbit hole. That was very entertaining on my hat.
If you didn't expect it, that just means he's not a listener.
That's a good point, because that's about 90% of our show is these little rabbit holes, and I enjoy it. Anything you want to let our listeners know before we call this call it a night, Corey?
I guess I will just wrap it up by saying, you know, the situation, I think it's very interesting. This whole situation has highlighted sort of the paradox between the lovers of parliamentary systems who always bash the American system that we have. You know, there's always people talking about, oh, I wish we had one of those stable parliamentary systems instead of our raucous American system of government. But, you know, we're finally seeing it exposed in a country that gets a lot of media attention as sort of not as stable as it might initially be made out to be. And I think there's a whole debate probably saved for a whole nother podcast about the merit over parliamentary versus Madisonian systems of government. But I do think it's interesting, and it really highlights why we do live in such a special system, which I think sort of gives people the most say in their government. You know, we're seeing a lot of leadership changes and leadership votes and this and that, but you know, who's choosing these people? It's not really the electorate. It's the members of parliament. It's the members of government. It's the people who are picked by the party to be in the government. Whereas in our system, we have primaries, we have caucuses, you know, we have different ways for people to make their voices heard themselves. And we don't have systems that enable duly elected people that we chose to sort of be usurped in their power. And so for that reason, I am a Madisonian absolutist, and I think it's very interesting to watch it play out in full time. It's been very entertaining.
It's been very entertaining, to say the least. Mr. Delecto, anything you want to say before we wrap this up?
I was just going to throw in that the previous Conservative Party leadership process was effectively their equivalent of a primary campaign. You know, it was at a weird time, but I'd say it wasn't that far different from like a party primary in this country.
Right, that's correct. But you know, look at who won that primary. It was Liz Truss got 57% of the vote, and now guy who got 43% of the vote is going to be in charge.
Yeah, but we'll see for how long though. So
that is true.
If there's one thing the parliamentary system is good at, it's getting people out of power.
Yeah,
that is.
Oh, I've said that. I've said that a lot. As much as I hate the idea of complimenting Britain, like one thing that's kind of fun about the parliamentary system is it ensures that the head of government resigns in disgrace.
And I was thinking about you when I saw the Liz Truss notification that she was resigning. I thought about you when you said that. I was like, court was right. They always do this.
Yeah. Would you consider yourself a Madisonian absolutist, Mr. Delecto?
No, I'm politically fluid.
Beautiful. Corey, Francois, thank you so much for coming on the show.
If I had to pick, I'd go with Bitcoin-based monarchism.
Well, right. And you can hear him talk about that in a previous episode. Wait, yeah, that was kind of, that's what you're talking about, that Bitcoin monarchism weird supply chain, whatever.
Blockchain.
blockchain, there it is. I had a Biden moment and almost just gave up on in the middle of my sentence, but thank you.
Well, hey,
you know the thing.
On the bright side, now that Rishi's taking over Mr. Silicon Valley, you might get your Bitcoin-based monarchism.
I don't think he's from the right side of Silicon Valley, but we'll see.
I guess we'll see.
All right. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you, Court.
Thank you, Court.